This is disc number 2.
How much would you like? She asked. It doesn't matter. I'll leave that up to you.
500?
That would be more than enough.
Good. I'll go get my checkbook.
Virginia Stillman stood up and smiled at Quinn again.
I'll get you a picture of Peter's father, too. I think I know just where it is.
Quinn thanked her and said he would wait. He watched her leave the room and once again found himself imagining what she would look like without any clothes on. Was she somehow coming on to him, he wondered, or was it just his own mind trying to sabotage him again? He decided to postpone his meditations and take up the subject again later. Virginia Stillman walked back into the room and said,
"Here's the check. I hope I made it out correctly."
Yes, yes, thought Quinn as he examined the check. Everything is tip-top. He was pleased with his own cleverness. The check, of course, was made out to Paul Auster, which meant that Quinn could not be held accountable for impersonating a private detective without a license. It reassured him to know that he had somehow put himself in the clear. The fact that he would never be able to cash the check did not trouble him. He understood even then that he was not doing any of this for money. He slipped the check into the inside breast pocket of his jacket.
"I'm sorry there's not a more recent photograph," Virginia Stillman was saying. "This one dates from more than 20 years ago, but I'm afraid it's the best I can do."
Quinn looked at the picture of Stillman's face, hoping for a sudden epiphany, some sudden rush of subterranean knowledge that would help him to understand the man. But the picture told him nothing. It was no more than a picture of a man. He studied it for a moment longer and concluded that it could just as easily have been anyone. "I'll look at it more carefully when I get home," he said, putting it into the same pocket where the check had gone. "Taking the passage of time into account, I'm sure I'll be able to recognize him at the station tomorrow."
"I hope so," said Virginia Stillman. "It's terribly important, and I'm counting on you."
"Don't worry," said Quinn. "I haven't let anyone down yet." She walked into the door. For several seconds, they stood there in silence, not knowing whether there was something to add or if the time had come to say goodbye. In that tiny interval, Virginia Stillman suddenly threw her arms around Quinn, sought out his lips with her own, and kissed him passionately, driving her tongue deep inside his mouth. Quinn was so taken off guard that he almost failed to enjoy it. When he was at last able to breathe again, Mrs. Stillman held him at arm's length and said,
"That was to prove that Peter wasn't telling you the truth. It's very important that you believe me."
"I believe you," said Quinn. "And even if I didn't believe you, it wouldn't really matter."
"I just wanted you to know what I'm capable of."
"I think I have a good idea." She took his right hand in her two hands and kissed it.
"Thank you, Mr. Auster. I really do think you're the answer."
He promised he would call her the next night, and then he found himself walking out the door, taking the elevator downstairs and leaving the building. It was past midnight when he hit the street. Chapter 4 Quinn had heard of cases like Peter Stillman before. Back in the days of his other life, not long after his own son was born, he had written a review of a book about the wild boy of Aveyron, and at the time he had done some research on the subject. As far as he could remember, the earliest account of such an experiment appeared in the writings of Herodotus. The Egyptian pharaoh Psamtik isolated two infants in the 7th century BC and commanded the servant in charge of them never to utter a word in their presence. According to Herodotus, a notoriously unreliable chronicler, the children learned to speak.
their first word being the Phrygian word for bread. In the Middle Ages, the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick II repeated the experiment, hoping to discover man's true natural language using similar methods, but the children died before they ever spoke any words. Finally, in what was undoubtedly a hoax, the early 16th century King of Scotland, James IV, claimed that Scottish children isolated in the same manner wound up speaking very good Hebrew. Cranks and ideologues, however, were not the only ones interested in the subject. Even so sane and skeptical a man as Montaigne considered the question carefully, and in his most important essay, The Apology for Raymond Sebond, he wrote, "I believe that a child who had been brought up in complete solitude, remote from all association, which would be a hard experiment to make, would have some sort of speech to express his ideas. And it is not credible that nature has denied us this resource that she has given to many other animals. But it is yet to be known what language this child would speak, and what has been said about it by conjecture has not much appearance of truth." Beyond the cases of such experiments, there were also the cases of accidental isolation. Children lost in the woods, sailors marooned on islands, children brought up by wolves, as well as the cases of cruel and sadistic parents who locked up their children, chained them to beds, beat them in closets, tortured them, for no other reason than the compulsions of their own madness. And Quinn had read through the extensive literature devoted to these stories. There was the Scottish sailor Alexander Selkirk, thought by some to be the model for Robinson Crusoe, who had lived for 4 years alone on an island off the coast of Chile, and who, according to the ship captain who rescued him in 1708, had so much forgot his language for want of use that we could scarce understand him. Less than 20 years later, Peter of Hanover, a wild child of about 14, who had been discovered mute and naked in a forest outside the German town of Hamelin, was brought to the English court under the special protection of George I. Both Swift and Defoe were given a chance to see him, and the experience led to Defoe's 1726 pamphlet, Mere Nature Delineated. Peter never learned to speak, however, and several months later was sent to the country, where he lived to the age of 70 with no interest in sex, money, or other worldly matters. Then there was the case of Victor, the wild boy of Aveyron, who was found in 1800. Under the patient and meticulous care of Dr. Itard, Victor learned some of the rudiments of speech, but he never progressed beyond the level of a small child. Even better known than Victor was Caspar Hauser, who appeared one afternoon in Nuremberg in 1828, dressed in an outlandish costume and barely able to utter an intelligible sound. He was able to write his name, but in all other respects, he behaved like an infant. Adopted by the town and entrusted to the care of a local teacher, he spent his days sitting on the floor playing with toy horses, eating only bread and water. Caspar, nevertheless, developed. He became an excellent horseman, became obsessively neat, had a passion for the colors red and white, and by all accounts displayed an extraordinary memory, especially for names and faces. Still, he preferred to remain indoors, shunned bright light, and, like Peter of Hanover, never showed any interest in sex or money. As the memory of his past gradually came back to him, he was able to recall how he had spent many years on the floor of a darkened room, fed by a man who never spoke to him or let himself be seen. Not long after these disclosures, Caspar was murdered by an unknown man with a dagger in a public park. It had been years now since Quinn had allowed himself to think of these stories. The subject of children was too painful for him, especially children who had suffered, had been mistreated, had died before they could grow up. If Stillman was the man with the dagger, come back to avenge himself on the boy whose life he had destroyed, Quinn wanted to be there to stop him. He knew he could not bring his own son back to life, but at least he could prevent another from dying. It had suddenly become possible for him to do this, and standing there on the street now, the idea of what lay before him loomed up like a terrible dream. He thought of the little coffin that held his son's body, and how he had seen it on the day of the funeral being lowered into the ground. That was isolation, he said to himself. That was silence. It did not help, perhaps, that his son's name had also been Peter. Chapter 5. At the corner of 72nd Street and Madison Avenue, he waved down a cab. As the car rattled through the park toward the west side, Quinn looked out the window and wondered if these were the same trees that Peter Stillman saw when he walked out into the air and the light. He wondered if Peter saw the same things he did, or whether the world was a different place for him. And if a tree was not a tree, he wondered what it really was. After the cab had dropped him off in front of his house, Quinn realized that he was hungry. He had not eaten since breakfast early that morning. It was strange, he thought, how quickly time had passed in the Stillman apartment. If his calculations were correct, he had been there for more than 14 hours. Within himself, however, it felt as though his stay had lasted 3 or 4 hours at most. He shrugged at the discrepancy and said to himself, "I must learn to look at my watch more often." He retraced his path along 107th Street, turned left on Broadway, and began walking uptown, looking for a suitable place to eat. A bar did not appeal to him tonight, eating in the dark, the press of boozy chatter, although normally he might have welcomed it. As he crossed 112th Street, he saw that the Heights Luncheonette was still open and decided to go in. It was a brightly lit yet dreary place, with a large rack of girly magazines on one wall, an area for stationery supplies, another area for newspapers, several tables for patrons, and a long formica counter with swivel stools. A tall Puerto Rican man in a white cardboard chef's hat stood behind the counter. It was his job to make the food, which consisted mainly of gristle-studded hamburger patties, bland sandwiches with pale tomatoes and wilted lettuce, milkshakes, egg creams, and buns. To his right, ensconced behind the cash register, was the boss, a small, balding man with curly hair and a concentration camp number tattooed on his forearm, lording it over his domain of cigarettes, pipes, and cigars. He sat there impassively, reading the Night Owl edition of the next morning's Daily News. The place was almost deserted at that hour. At the back table sat two old men in shabby clothes, one very fat and the other very thin, intently studying the racing forms. Two empty coffee cups sat on the table between them. In the foreground, facing the magazine rack, a young student stood with an open magazine in his hands, staring at a picture of a naked woman. Quinn sat down at the counter and ordered a hamburger and a coffee. As the counterman swung into action, he spoke over his shoulder to Quinn. "Did you see the game tonight, man?" "I missed it. Anything good to report?" "What do you think?" For several years, Quinn had been having the same conversation with this man, whose name he did not know. Once, when he had been in the luncheonette, they had talked about baseball, and now, each time Quinn came in, they continued to talk about it. In the winter, the talk was of trades, predictions, memories. During the season, it was always the most recent game. They were both Mets fans, and the hopelessness of that passion had created a bond between them. The counterman shook his head. "First two times up, Kingman hits solo shots," he said. "Boom, boom, big mothers, all the way to the moon. Jones is pitching good for once and things don't look too bad. It's 2-1, bottom of the ninth. Pittsburgh gets men on second and third, one out, so the Mets go to the bullpen for Allen. He walks the next guy to load them up.
The Mets bring the corners in for a force at home, or maybe they can get the double play if it's hit up the middle. Peña comes up and Chicken chits a little grounder to first, and the fucker goes through Kingman's legs. Two men score, and that's it. Bye-bye, New York.
Dave Kingman is a turd, said Quinn, biting into his hamburger.
But watch out for Foster, said the counterman.
Foster's washed up, a has-been, a mean-faced bozo.
Quinn chewed his food carefully, feeling with his tongue for stray bits of bone.
They should ship him back to Cincinnati by express mail.
Yeah, said the counterman,
but that'll be tough. Better than last year, anyway.
I don't know, said Quinn, taking another bite. It looks good on paper, but what do they really have?
Stearns is always getting hurt. They have minor leaguers at second and short, and Brooks can't keep his mind on the game.
Mookie's good, but he's raw, and they can't even decide who to put in right.
They're still Rusty, of course, but he's too fat to run anymore. And as for the pitching, forget it. You and I could go over to Shea tomorrow and get hired as the top two starters.
Maybe I make you the manager, said the counterman. You could tell those fuckers where to get off.
You bet your bottom dollar, said Quinn.
After he finished eating, Quinn wandered over to the stationery shelves. A shipment of new notebooks had come in, and the pile was impressive, a beautiful array of blues and greens and reds and yellows. He picked one up and saw that the pages had the narrow lines he preferred. Quinn did all his writing with a pen, using a typewriter only for final drafts, and he was always on the lookout for good spiral notebooks. Now that he had embarked on the Stillman case, he felt that a new notebook was in order. It would be helpful to have a separate place to record his thoughts, his observations, and his questions. In that way, perhaps, things might not get out of control. He looked through the pile, trying to decide which one to pick. For reasons that were never made clear to him, he suddenly felt an irresistible urge for a particular red notebook at the bottom. He pulled it out and examined it, gingerly fanning the pages with his thumb. He was at a loss to explain to himself why he found it so appealing. It was a standard 8.5 by 11 notebook with 100 pages. But something about it seemed to call out to him, as if its unique destiny in the world was to hold the words that came from his pen. Almost embarrassed by the intensity of his feelings, Quinn tucked the red notebook under his arm, walked over to the cash register, and bought it. Back in his apartment a quarter of an hour later, Quinn removed the photograph of Stillman and the check from his jacket pocket and placed them carefully on his desk. He cleared the debris from the surface, dead matches, cigarette butts, eddies of ash, spent ink cartridges, a few coins, ticket stubs, doodles, a dirty handkerchief, and put the red notebook in the center. Then he drew the shades in the room, took off all his clothes, and sat down at the desk. He had never done this before, but it somehow seemed appropriate to be naked at this moment. He sat there for 20 or 30 seconds, trying not to move, trying not to do anything but breathe. Then he opened the red notebook. He picked up his pen and wrote his initials, DQ, for Daniel Quinn, on the first page. It was the first time in more than 5 years that he had put his own name in one of his notebooks. He stopped to consider this fact for a moment, but then dismissed it as irrelevant. He turned the page. For several moments, he studied its blankness, wondering if he was not a bloody fool. Then he pressed his pen against the top line and made the first entry in the red notebook.
Stillman's face. Or Stillman's face as it was 20 years ago. Impossible to know whether the face tomorrow will resemble it. It is certain, however, that this is not the face of a madman. Or is this not a legitimate statement? To my eyes, at least, it seems benign, if not downright pleasant. A hint of tenderness around the mouth, even. More than likely blue eyes,
with a tendency to water. Thin hair even then, so perhaps gone now, and what remains gray or even white. He bears an odd familiarity, the meditative type, no doubt high-strung, someone who might stutter, fight with himself to stem the flood of words rushing from his mouth. Little Peter. Is it necessary for me to imagine it, or can I accept it on faith? The darkness. To think of myself in that room, screaming. I am reluctant. Nor do I think I even want to understand it. To what end? This is not a story, after all. It is a fact, something happening in the world, and I am supposed to do a job, one little thing, and I have said yes to it. If all goes well, it should even be quite simple. I have not been hired to understand, merely to act. This is something new. To keep it in mind, at all costs. And yet, what is it that Dupin says in Poe? An identification of the reasoner's intellect with that of his opponent. But here it would apply to Stillman Sr., which is probably even worse. As for Virginia, I am in a quandary. Not just the kiss, which might be explained by any number of reasons, not what Peter said about her, which is unimportant. Her marriage? Perhaps. The complete incongruity of it. Could it be that she's in it for the money? Or somehow working in collaboration with Stillman? That would change everything. But at the same time, it makes no sense. For why would she have hired me? To have a witness to her apparent good intentions? Perhaps. But that seems too complicated. And yet, why do I feel she is not to be trusted? Stillman's face again. Thinking for these past few minutes that I have seen it before, perhaps years ago in the neighborhood, before the time of his arrest. To remember what it feels like to wear other people's clothes. To begin with that, I think, assuming I must. Back in the old days, 18, 20 years ago, when I had no money and friends would give me things to wear, Jay's old overcoat in college, for example, and the strange sense I would have of climbing into his skin. That is probably a start. And then, most important of all, to remember who I am. To remember who I am supposed to be. I do not think this is a game. On the other hand, nothing is clear. For example, who are you? And if you think you know, why do you keep lying about it? I have no answer. All I can say is this. Listen to me. My name is Paul Auster. That is not my real name. Chapter 6. Quinn spent the next morning at the Columbia Library with Stillman's book. He arrived early, the first one there as the doors opened, and the silence of the marble halls comforted him, as though he had been allowed to enter some crypt of oblivion. After flashing his alumni card at the drowsing attendant behind the desk, he retrieved the book from the stacks, returned to the third floor, and then settled down in a green leather armchair in one of the smoking rooms. The bright May morning lurked outside like a temptation, a call to wander aimlessly in the air, but Quinn fought it off. He turned the chair around, positioning himself with his back to the window, and opened the book. The Garden and the Tower, Early Visions of the New World, was divided into two parts of approximately equal length, The Myth of Paradise and The Myth of Babel. The first concentrated on the discoveries of the explorers, beginning with Columbus, and continuing on through Raleigh. It was Stillman's contention that the first men to visit America believed they had accidentally found paradise, a second Garden of Eden. In the narrative of his third voyage, for example, Columbus wrote, "For I believe that the earthly paradise lies here, which no one can enter except by God's leave." As for the people of this land, Peter Martyr would write as early as 1505, "They seem to live in that golden world of which old writers speak so much, wherein men lived simply and innocently, without enforcement of laws, without quarreling, judges, or libels, content only to satisfy nature." Or, as the ever-present Montaigne would write more than half a century later, "In my opinion, what we actually see in these nations not only surpasses all the pictures which the poets have drawn of the Golden Age and all their inventions representing the then happy state of mankind, but also the conception and desire of philosophy itself." From the very beginning, according to Stillman, the discovery of the New World was the quickening impulse of utopian thought, the spark that gave hope to the perfectibility of human life. From Thomas More's book of 1516 to Geronimo de Mendieta's prophecy some years later that America would become an ideal theocratic state, a veritable city of God. There was, however, an opposite point of view. If some saw the Indians as living in prelapsarian innocence, there were others who judged them to be savage beasts, devils in the form of men. The discovery of cannibals in the Caribbean did nothing to assuage this opinion. The Spaniards used it as a justification to exploit the natives mercilessly for their own mercantile ends. For if you do not consider the man before you to be human, there are few restraints of conscience on your behavior towards him. It was not until 1537, with the papal bull of Paul III, that the Indians were declared to be true men possessing souls. The debate, nevertheless, went on for several hundred years, culminating on the one hand in the noble savage of Locke and Rousseau, which laid the theoretical foundations of democracy in an independent America, and on the other hand in the campaign to exterminate the Indians, and the undying belief that the only good Indian was a dead Indian. The second part of the book began with a new examination of the fall. Relying heavily on Milton and his account in Paradise Lost, as representing the orthodox Puritan position, Stillman claimed that it was only after the fall that human life as we know it came into being. For if there was no evil in the garden, neither was there any good. As Milton himself put it in the Areopagitica, "It was out of the rind of one apple tasted that good and evil leapt forth into the world, like two twins cleaving together." Stillman's gloss on this sentence was exceedingly thorough. Alert to the possibility of puns and wordplay throughout, he showed how the word taste was actually a reference to the Latin word sapere, which means both to taste and to know, and therefore contains a subliminal reference to the tree of knowledge, the source of the apple whose taste brought forth knowledge into the world, which is to say, good and evil. Stillman also dwelled on the paradox of the word cleave, which means both to join together and to break apart, thus embodying two equal and opposite significations, which in turn embodies a view of language that Stillman found to be present in all of Milton's work. In Paradise Lost, for example, each key word has two meanings, one before the fall and one after the fall. To illustrate his point, Stillman isolated several of those words, sinister, serpentine, delicious, and showed how their prelapsarian use was free of moral connotations, whereas their use after the fall was shaded, ambiguous, informed by a knowledge of evil. Adam's one task in the garden had been to invent language, to give each creature and thing its name. In that state of innocence, his tongue had gone straight to the quick of the world. His words had not been merely appended to the things he saw. They had revealed their essences, had literally brought them to life. A thing and its name were interchangeable. After the fall, this was no longer true. Names became detached from things. Words devolved into a collection of arbitrary signs. Language had been severed from God. The story of the garden, therefore, records not only the fall of man, but the fall of language. Later in the book of Genesis, there is another story about language. According to Stillman, The Tower of Babel episode was an exact recapitulation of what happened in the garden, only expanded, made general in its significance for all mankind. The story takes on special meaning when its placement in the book is considered. Chapter 11 of Genesis, verses 1 through 9. This is the very last incident of prehistory in the Bible. After that, the Old Testament is exclusively a chronicle of the Hebrews. In other words, the Tower of Babel stands as the last image before the true beginning of the world. Stillman's commentaries went on for many pages. He began with a historical survey of the various exegetical traditions concerning the story, elaborated on the numerous misreadings that had grown up around it, and ended with a lengthy catalog of legends from the Haggadah, a compendium of rabbinical interpretations not connected with legal matters. It was generally accepted, wrote Stillman, that the tower had been built in the year 1996 after the creation, a scant 340 years after the flood, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. God's punishment came as a response to this desire, which contradicted a command that had appeared earlier in Genesis, "Be fertile and increase, fill the earth and master it." By destroying the tower, therefore, God condemned man to obey this injunction. Another reading, however, saw the tower as a challenge against God. Nimrod, the first ruler of all the world, was designated as the tower's architect. Babel was to be a shrine that symbolized the universality of his power. This was the Promethean view of the story, and it hinged on the phrases, "whose top may reach unto heaven," and "let us make a name." The building of the tower became the obsessive, overriding passion of mankind, more important, finally, than life itself. Bricks became more precious than people. Women laborers did not even stop to give birth to their children. They secured the newborn in their aprons and went right on working. Apparently, there were three different groups involved in the construction: those who wanted to dwell in heaven, those who wanted to wage war against God, and those who wanted to worship idols. At the same time, they were united in their efforts, and the whole earth was one language and of one speech. And the latent power of a united mankind outraged God. And the Lord said, "Behold, the people is one, and they have all one language, and this they begin to do. And now nothing will be restrained from them, which they have imagined to do." This speech is a conscious echo of the words God spoke on expelling Adam and Eve from the garden. "Behold, the man has become one of us, to know good and evil. And now, lest he put forth his hand and take also of the tree of life, and eat, and live forever." Therefore the Lord God sent him forth from the Garden of Eden. Still another reading held that the story was intended merely as a way of explaining the diversity of peoples and languages. For if all men were descended from Noah and his sons, how was it possible to account for the vast differences among cultures? Another similar reading contended that the story was an explanation of the existence of paganism and idolatry. For until this story, all men are presented as being monotheistic in their beliefs. As for the tower itself, legend had it that one-third of the structure sank into the ground, one-third was destroyed by fire, and one-third was left standing. God attacked it in two ways in order to convince man that the destruction was a divine punishment and not the result of chance. Still, the part left standing was so high that a palm tree seen from the top of it appeared no larger than a grasshopper. It was also said that a person could walk for 3 days in the shadow of the tower without ever leaving it. Finally, and Stillman dwelled upon this at great length, whoever looked upon the ruins of the tower was believed to forget everything he knew. What all this had to do with the new world, Quinn could not say. But then a new chapter started. And suddenly, Stillman was discussing the life of Henry Dark, a Boston clergyman who was born in London in 1649. On the day of Charles I's execution, came to America in 1675, and died in a fire in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in 1691. According to Stillman, as a young man, Henry Dark had served as private secretary to John Milton from 1669 until the poet's death, 5 years later. This was news to Quinn, for he seemed to remember reading somewhere that the blind Milton had dictated his work to one of his daughters. Dark, he learned, was an ardent Puritan, a student of theology, and a devoted follower of Milton's work. Having met his hero one evening at a small gathering, he was invited to pay a call the following week. That led to further calls, until eventually Milton began to entrust Dark with various small tasks, taking dictation, guiding him through the streets of London, reading to him from the works of the ancients. In a 1672 letter written by Dark to his sister in Boston, he mentioned long discussions with Milton on the finer points of biblical exegesis. Then Milton died, and Dark was disconsolate. 6 months later, finding England a desert, a land that offered him nothing, he decided to emigrate to America. He arrived in Boston in the summer of 1675. Little was known of his first years in the New World. Stillman speculated that he might have traveled westward, foraging out into uncharted territory, but no concrete evidence could be found to support this view. On the other hand, certain references in Dark's writings indicated an intimate knowledge of Indian customs, which led Stillman to theorize that Dark might possibly have lived among one of the tribes for a period of time. Be that as it may, there was no public mention of Dark until 1682, when his name was entered in the Boston Marriage Registry as having taken one Lucy Fitz as his bride. 2 years later, he was listed as heading a small Puritan congregation on the outskirts of the city. Several children were born to the couple, but all of them died in infancy. A son, John, however, born in 1686, survived. But in 1691, the boy was reported to have fallen accidentally from a second-story window and perished. Just 1 month later, the entire house went up in flames, and both Dark and his wife were killed. Henry Dark would have passed into the obscurity of early American life if not for one thing: the publication of a pamphlet in 1690 entitled The New Babel. According to Stillman, this little work of 64 pages was the most visionary account of the new continent that had been written up to that time. If Dark had not died so soon after its appearance, its effect would no doubt have been greater. For, as it turned out, most of the copies of the pamphlet were destroyed in the fire that killed Dark. Stillman himself had been able to discover only one, and that by accident, in the attic of his family's house in Cambridge. After years of diligent research, he had concluded that this was the only copy still in existence. The New Babel, written in bold Miltonic prose, presented the case for the building of paradise in America. Unlike the other writers on the subject, Dark did not assume paradise to be a place that could be discovered. There were no maps that could lead a man to it, no instruments of navigation that could guide a man to its shores. Rather, its existence was imminent within man himself. The idea of a beyond he might someday create in the here and now. For utopia was nowhere, even, as Dark explained, in its wordhood. And if man could bring forth this dreamed-of place, it would only be by building it with his own two hands. Dark based his conclusions on a reading of the Babel story as a prophetic work. Drawing heavily on Milton's interpretation of the fall, he followed his master in placing an inordinate importance on the role of language. But he took the poet's ideas one step further. If the fall of man also entailed a fall of language, was it not logical to assume that it would be possible to undo the fall to reverse its effects by undoing the fall of language, by striving to recreate the language that was spoken in Eden. If man could learn to speak this original language of innocence, did it not follow that he would thereby recover a state of innocence within himself? We had only to look at the example of Christ, Dark argued, to understand that this was so. For was Christ not a man, a creature of flesh and blood? And did not Christ speak this prelapsarian language? In Milton's Paradise Regained, Satan speaks with double sense deluding, whereas Christ's actions to his words accord, his words to his large heart give utterance due, his heart contains of good, wise, just, the perfect shape. And had God not now sent his living oracle into the world to teach his final will, and sends his Spirit of Truth henceforth to dwell in pious hearts, an inward oracle to all truth requisite for me to know? And because of Christ, did the fall not have a happy outcome? Was it not a felix culpa, as doctrine instructs? Therefore, Dark contended, it would indeed be possible for man to speak the original language of innocence and to recover, whole and unbroken, the truth within himself. Turning to the Babel story, Dark then elaborated his plan and announced his vision of things to come. Quoting from the second verse of Genesis 11, "And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there." Dark stated that this passage proved the westward movement of human life and civilization, for the city of Babel, or Babylon, was situated in Mesopotamia, far east of the land of the Hebrews. If Babel lay to the west of anything, it was Eden, the original site of mankind. Man's duty to scatter himself across the whole earth, in response to God's command to be fertile and fill the earth, would inevitably move along a western course. And what more western land in all Christendom, Dark asked, than America? The movement of English settlers to the New World, therefore, could be read as the fulfillment of the ancient commandment. America was the last step in the process. Once the continent had been filled, the moment would be ripe for a change in the fortunes of mankind. The impediment to the building of Babel, that man must fill the earth, would be eliminated. At that moment, it would again be possible for the whole earth to be of one language and one speech. And if that were to happen, paradise could not be far behind. Just as Babel had been built 340 years after the flood, so it would be, Dark predicted, exactly 340 years after the arrival of the Mayflower at Plymouth, that the commandment would be carried out. For surely it was the Puritans, God's newly chosen people, who held the destiny of mankind in their hands. Unlike the Hebrews, who had failed God by refusing to accept his son, these transplanted Englishmen would write the final chapter of history before heaven and earth were joined at last. Like Noah in his ark, they had traveled across the vast oceanic flood to carry out their holy mission. 340 years, according to Dark's calculations, meant that in 1960, the first part of the settlers' work would have been done. At that point, the foundations would have been laid for the real work that was to follow, the building of the new Babel. Already, Dark wrote, he saw encouraging signs in the city of Boston, for there, as nowhere else in the world, the chief construction material was brick, which, as set forth in verse 3 of Genesis 11, was specified as the construction material of Babel. In the year 1960, he stated confidently, the new Babel would begin to go up, its very shape aspiring toward the heavens, a symbol of the resurrection of the human spirit. History would be written in reverse. What had fallen would be raised up. What had been broken would be made whole. Once completed, the tower would be large enough to hold every inhabitant of the new world. There would be a room for each person, and once he entered that room, he would forget everything he knew. After 40 days and 40 nights, he would emerge a new man, speaking God's language, prepared to inhabit the second, everlasting paradise. So ended Stillman's synopsis of Henry Dark's pamphlet, dated December 26, 1690, the 70th anniversary of the landing of the Mayflower. Quinn let out a little sigh and closed the book. The reading room was empty. He leaned forward, put his head in his hands, and closed his eyes. 1960, he said aloud. He tried to conjure up an image of Henry Dark, but nothing came to him. In his mind, he saw only fire, a blaze of burning books. Then, losing track of his thoughts and where they had been leading him, he suddenly remembered that 1960 was the year that Stillman had locked up his son. He opened the red notebook and set it squarely on his lap. Just as he was about to write in it, however, he decided that he had had enough. He closed the red notebook, got up from his chair, and returned Stillman's book to the front desk. Lighting a cigarette at the bottom of the stairs, he left the library and walked out into the May afternoon. Chapter 7. He made it to Grand Central well in advance. Stillman's train was not due to arrive until 6:41, but Quinn wanted time to study the geography of the place, to make sure that Stillman would not be able to slip away from him. As he emerged from the subway and entered the Great Hall, he saw by the clock that it was just past 4. Already the station had begun to fill with the rush hour crowd. Making his way through the press of oncoming bodies, Quinn made a tour of the numbered gates, looking for hidden staircases, unmarked exits, dark alcoves. He concluded that a man determined to disappear could do so without much trouble. He would have to hope that Stillman had not been warned that he would be there. If that were the case, and Stillman managed to elude him, it would mean that Virginia Stillman was responsible. There was no one else. It solaced him to know that he had an alternate plan if things went awry. If Stillman did not show up, Quinn would go straight to 69th Street and confront Virginia Stillman with what he knew. As he wandered through the station, he reminded himself of who he was supposed to be. The effect of being Paul Auster, he had begun to learn, was not altogether unpleasant. Although he still had the same body, the same mind, the same thoughts, he felt as though he had somehow been taken out of himself, as if he no longer had to walk around with the burden of his own consciousness. By a simple trick of the intelligence, a deft little twist of naming, he felt incomparably lighter and freer. At the same time, he knew it was all an illusion, but there was a certain comfort in that. He had not really lost himself, he was merely pretending, and he could return to being Quinn whenever he wished. The fact that there was now a purpose to his being Paul Auster, a purpose that was becoming more and more important to him, served as a kind of moral justification for the charade and absolved him of having to defend his lie. For imagining himself as Auster had become synonymous in his mind with doing good in the world. He wandered through the station then, as if inside the body of Paul Auster, waiting for Stillman to appear. He looked up at the vaulted ceiling of the Great Hall and studied the fresco of constellations. There were light bulbs representing the stars and line drawings of the celestial figures. Quinn had never been able to grasp the connection between the constellations and their names. As a boy, he had spent many hours under the night sky trying to tally the clusters of pinprick lights with the shapes of bears, bulls, archers, and water carriers, but nothing had ever come of it, and he had felt stupid, as though there were a blind spot in the center of his brain. He wondered if the young Auster had been any better at it than he was. Across the way, occupying the greater part of the station's east wall, was the Kodak display photograph, with its bright, unearthly colors. The scene that month showed a street in some New England fishing village, perhaps Nantucket. A beautiful spring light shone on the cobblestones. Flowers of many colors stood in window boxes along the house fronts, and far down at the end of the street was the ocean, with its white waves and blue, blue water. Quinn remembered visiting Nantucket with his wife long ago, in her first month of pregnancy, when his son was no more than a tiny almond in her belly. He found it painful to think of that now, and he tried to suppress the pictures that were forming in his head. "Look at it through Oster's eyes," he said to himself, "and don't think of anything else." He turned his attention to the photograph again and was relieved to find his thoughts wandering to the subject of whales, to the expeditions that had set out from Nantucket in the last century, to Melville and the opening pages of Moby Dick. From there, his mind drifted off to the accounts he had read of Melville's last years, the taciturn old man working in the New York Customs House, with no readers, forgotten by everyone. Then, suddenly, with great clarity and precision, he saw Bartleby's window and the blank brick wall before him. Someone tapped him on the arm. And as Quinn wheeled to meet the assault, he saw a short, silent man holding out a green and red ballpoint pen to him. Stapled to the pen was a little white paper flag, one side of which read, "This good article is the courtesy of a deaf mute. Pay any price. Thank you for your help." On the other side of the flag there was a chart of the manual alphabet, "Learn to speak to your friends," that showed the hand positions for each of the 26 letters. Quinn reached into his pocket and gave the man a dollar. The deaf mute nodded once, very briefly, and then moved on, leaving Quinn with the pen in his hand. It was now past 5 o'clock. Quinn decided he would be less vulnerable in another spot and removed himself to the waiting room. This was generally a grim place, filled with dust and people with nowhere to go, but now, with the rush hour at full force, it had been taken over by men and women with briefcases, books, and newspapers. Quinn had trouble finding a seat. After searching for 2 or 3 minutes, he finally found a place on one of the benches, wedging himself between a man in a blue suit and a plump young woman. The man was reading a sports section of the Times, and Quinn glanced over to read the account of the Mets' loss the night before. He had made it to the 3rd or 4th paragraph when the man turned slowly toward him, gave him a vicious stare, and jerked the paper out of view. After that, a strange thing happened. Quinn turned his attention to the young woman on his right to see if there was any reading material in that direction. Quinn guessed her age at around 20. There were several pimples on her left cheek, obscured by a pinkish smear of pancake makeup, and a wad of chewing gum was crackling in her mouth. She was, however, reading a book, a paperback with a lurid cover, and Quinn leaned ever so slightly to his right to catch a glimpse of the title. Against all his expectations, it was a book he himself had written, Suicide Squeeze by William Wilson, the first of the Max Work novels. Quinn had often imagined this situation, the sudden, unexpected pleasure of encountering one of his readers. He had even imagined the conversation that would follow. He, suavely diffident as the stranger praised the book, and then, with great reluctance and modesty, agreeing to autograph the title page, "since you insist." But now that the scene was taking place, he felt quite disappointed, even angry. He did not like the girl sitting next to him, and it offended him that she should be casually skimming the pages that had cost him so much effort. His impulse was to tear the book out of her hands and run across the station with it. He looked at her face again, trying to hear the words she was sounding out in her head, watching her eyes as they darted back and forth across the page. He must have been looking too hard, for a moment later she turned to him with an irritated expression on her face and said, "You got a problem, mister?" Quinn smiled weakly. "No problem," he said. "I was just wondering if you liked the book." The girl shrugged.
I've read better and I've read worse.
Quinn wanted to drop the conversation right there, but something in him persisted. Before he could get up and leave, the words were already out of his mouth.
Do you find it exciting?
The girl shrugged again and cracked her gum loudly.
Sort of. There's a part where the detective gets lost that's kind of scary.
Is he a smart detective?
Yeah, he's smart, but he talks too much.
You'd like more action?
I guess so.
If you don't like it, why do you go on reading?
I don't know.
The girl shrugged once again.
It passes the time, I guess. Anyway, it's no big deal. It's just a book.
He was about to tell her who he was, but then he realized that it made no difference. The girl was beyond hope. For 5 years, he had kept William Wilson's identity a secret, and he wasn't about to give it away now, least of all to an imbecile stranger. Still, it was painful, and he struggled desperately to swallow his pride. Rather than punch the girl in the face, he abruptly stood up from his seat and walked away. At 6:30, he posted himself in front of Gate 24. The train was due to arrive on time, and from his vantage in the center of the doorway, Quinn judged that his chances of seeing Stillman were good. He took out the photograph from his pocket and studied it again, paying special attention to the eyes. He remembered having read somewhere that the eyes were the one feature of the face that never changed. From childhood to old age, they remained the same, and a man with the head to see it could theoretically look into the eyes of a boy in a photograph and recognize the same person as an old man. Quinn had his doubts, but this was all he had to go on, his only bridge to the present. Once again, however, Stillman's face told him nothing. The train pulled into the station, and Quinn felt the noise of it shoot through his body. A random, hectic din that seemed to join with his pulse, pumping his blood in raucous spurts. His head then filled with Peter Stillman's voice, as a barrage of nonsense words clattered against the walls of his skull. He told himself to stay calm, but that did little good. In spite of what he had been expecting of himself at this moment, he was excited. The train was crowded, and as the passengers started filling the ramp and walking toward him, they quickly became a mob. Quinn flapped the red notebook nervously against his right thigh, stood on his tiptoes, and peered into the throng. Soon the people were surging around him. There were men and women, children and old people, teenagers and babies, rich people and poor people, black men and white women, white men and black women, Orientals and Arabs, men in brown and gray and blue and green, women in red and white and yellow and pink, children in sneakers, children in shoes, children in cowboy boots, fat people and thin people, tall people and short people, each one different from all the others, each one irreducibly himself. Quinn watched them all. Anchored to his spot, as if his whole being had been exiled to his eyes. Each time an elderly man approached, he braced himself for it to be Stillman. They came and went too quickly for him to indulge in disappointment, but in each old face he seemed to find an augur of what the real Stillman would be like, and he rapidly shifted his expectations with each new face. As if the accumulation of old men was heralding the imminent arrival of Stillman himself. For one brief instant, Quinn thought, so this is what detective work is like. But other than that, he thought nothing. He watched. Immobile among the moving crowd, he stood there and watched. With about half the passengers now gone, Quinn had his first sight of Stillman. The resemblance to the photograph seemed unmistakable. No. He had not gone bald, as Quinn had thought he would. His hair was white, and it lay on his head uncombed, sticking up here and there in tufts. He was tall, thin, without question past 60, somewhat stooped. Inappropriately for the season, he wore a long brown overcoat that had gone to seed, and he shuffled slightly as he walked. The expression on his face seemed placid, midway between a daze and thoughtfulness. He did not look at the things around him, nor did they seem to interest him. He had one piece of luggage, a once beautiful but now battered leather suitcase with a strap around it. Once or twice as he walked up the ramp, he put the suitcase down and rested for a moment. He seemed to be moving with effort, a bit thrown by the crowd, uncertain whether to keep up with it or to let the others pass him by. Quinn backed off several feet, positioning himself for a quick move to the left or right depending on what happened. At the same time, he wanted to be far enough away so that Stillman would not feel he was being followed. As Stillman reached the threshold of the station, he put his bag down once again and paused. At that moment, Quinn allowed himself a glance to Stillman's right, surveying the rest of the crowd to be doubly sure he had made no mistakes. What happened then defied explanation. Directly behind Stillman, heaving into view just inches behind his right shoulder, another man stopped, took a lighter out of his pocket, and lit a cigarette. His face was the exact twin of Stillman's. For a second, Quinn thought it was an illusion, a kind of aura thrown off by the electromagnetic currents in Stillman's body. But no, this other Stillman moved, breathed, blinked his eyes. His actions were clearly independent of the first Stillman. The second Stillman had a prosperous air about him. He was dressed in an expensive blue suit. His shoes were shined. His white hair was combed. And in his eyes, there was the shrewd look of a man of the world. He, too, was carrying a single bag, an elegant black suitcase, about the same size as the other Stillman's. Quinn froze. There was nothing he could do now that would not be a mistake. Whatever choice he made, and he had to make a choice, would be arbitrary, a submission to chance. Uncertainty would haunt him to the end. At that moment, the two Stillmans started on their way again. The first turned right, the second turned left. Quinn craved an amoeba's body, wanting to cut himself in half and run off in two directions at once. "Do something," he said to himself. "Do something now, you idiot!" For no reason, he went to his left, in pursuit of the second Stillman. After 9 or 10 paces, he stopped. Something told him he would live to regret what he was doing. He was acting out of spite, spurred on to punish the second Stillman for confusing him. He turned around and saw the first Stillman shuffling off in the other direction. Surely, this was his man, this shabby creature, so broken down and disconnected from his surroundings. Surely, this was the mad Stillman. Quinn breathed deeply, exhaled with a trembling chest, and breathed in again. There was no way to know. Not this, not anything. He went after the first Stillman, slowing his pace to match the old man's, and followed him to the subway. It was nearly 7 o'clock now, and the crowds had begun to thin out. Although Stillman seemed to be in a fog, he nevertheless knew where he was going. The professor went straight for the subway staircase, paid his money at the token booth below, and waited calmly on the platform for the Times Square shuttle. Quinn began to lose his fear of being noticed. He had never seen anyone so lost in his own thoughts. Even if he stood directly in front of him, he doubted that Stillman would be able to see him. They traveled to the west side on the shuttle, walked through the dank corridors of the 42nd Street station, and went down another set of stairs to the IRT trains. 7 or 8 minutes later, they boarded the Broadway Express, careened uptown for 2 long stops, and got off at 96th Street. Slowly making their way up the final staircase, with several pauses as Stillman set down his bag and caught his breath, they surfaced on the corner and entered the indigo evening. Stillman did not hesitate. Without stopping to get his bearings, he began walking up Broadway along the east side of the street. For several minutes, Quinn toyed with the irrational conviction that Stillman was walking toward his house on 107th Street. But before he could indulge himself in a full-blown panic, Stillman stopped at the corner of 99th Street, waited for the light to change from red to green, and crossed over to the other side of Broadway. Halfway up the block, there was a small flea bag for down-and-outs, the Hotel Harmony, Quinn had passed it many times before, and he was familiar with the winos and vagabonds who hung around the place. It surprised him to see Stillman open the front door and enter the lobby. Somehow he had assumed the old man would have found more comfortable lodgings, but as Quinn stood outside the glass-paneled door and saw the professor walk up to the desk, write what was undoubtedly his name in the guest book, pick up his bag and disappear into the elevator, he realized that this was where Stillman meant to stay. Quinn waited outside for the next 2 hours, pacing up and down the block, thinking that Stillman would perhaps emerge to look for dinner in one of the local coffee shops. But the old man did not appear, and at last, Quinn decided he must have gone to sleep. He put in a call to Virginia Stillman from a pay booth on the corner, gave her a full report of what had happened, and then headed home to 107th Street. Chapter 8. The next morning, and for many mornings to follow, Quinn posted himself on a bench in the middle of the traffic island at Broadway and 99th Street. He would arrive early, never later than 7 o'clock, and sit there with a takeout coffee, a buttered roll, and an open newspaper on his lap, watching the glass door of the hotel. By 8 o'clock, Stillman would come out, always in his long brown overcoat, carrying a large, old-fashioned carpet bag. For 2 weeks, this routine did not vary. The old man would wander through the streets of the neighborhood, advancing slowly, sometimes by the merest of increments, pausing, moving on again, pausing once more, as though each step had to be weighed and measured before it could take its place among the sum total of steps. Moving in this manner was difficult for Quinn. He was used to walking briskly, and all this starting and stopping and shuffling began to be a strain, as though the rhythm of his body was being disrupted. He was the hare in pursuit of the tortoise, and again he had to remind himself to hold back. What Stillman did on these walks remained something of a mystery to Quinn. He could, of course, see with his own eyes what happened, and all these things he dutifully recorded in his red notebook, but the meaning of these things continued to elude him. Stillman never seemed to be going anywhere in particular, nor did he seem to know where he was. And yet, as if by conscious design, he kept to a narrowly circumscribed area, bounded on the north by 110th Street, on the south by 72nd Street, on the west by Riverside Park, and on the east by Amsterdam Avenue. No matter how haphazard his journeys seemed to be, and each day his itinerary was different, Stillman never crossed these borders. Such precision baffled Quinn, for in all other respects, Stillman seemed to be aimless. As he walked, Stillman did not look up. His eyes were permanently fixed on the pavement, as though he were searching for something. Indeed, every now and then he would stoop down, pick some object off the ground, and examine it closely, turning it over and over in his hand. It made Quinn think of an archaeologist inspecting a shard at some prehistoric ruin. Occasionally, after poring over an object in this way, Stillman would toss it back onto the sidewalk. But more often than not, he would open his bag and lay the object gently inside it. Then, reaching into one of his coat pockets, he would remove a red notebook, similar to Quinn's, but smaller, and write in it with great concentration for a minute or two. Having completed this operation, he would return the notebook to his pocket, pick up his bag, and continue on his way. As far as Quinn could tell, the objects Stillman collected were valueless. They seemed to be no more than broken things, discarded things, stray bits of junk. Over the days that passed, Quinn noted a collapsible umbrella shorn of its material, the severed head of a rubber doll, a black glove, the bottom of a shattered light bulb, several pieces of printed matter, soggy magazines, shredded newspapers, a torn photograph, anonymous machinery parts, and sundry other clumps of flotsam he could not identify. The fact that Stillman took this scavenging seriously intrigued Quinn, But he could do no more than observe, write down what he saw in the red notebook, hover stupidly on the surface of things. At the same time, it pleased him to know that Stillman also had a red notebook, as if this formed a secret link between them. Quinn suspected that Stillman's red notebook contained answers to the questions that had been accumulating in his mind, and he began to plot various stratagems for stealing it from the old man. But the time had not yet come for such a step. Other than picking up objects from the street, Stillman seemed to do nothing. Every now and then he would stop somewhere for a meal. Occasionally he would bump into someone and mumble an apology. Once a car nearly ran him over as he was crossing the street. Stillman did not talk to anyone, did not go into any stores, did not smile. He seemed neither happy nor sad. Twice, when his scavenging haul had been unusually large, he returned to the hotel in the middle of the day and then reemerged a few minutes later with an empty bag. On most days, he spent at least several hours in Riverside Park, walking methodically along the macadam footpaths or else thrashing through the bushes with a stick. His quest for objects did not abate amidst the greenery. Stones, leaves, and twigs all found their way into his bag. Once, Quinn observed, he even stooped down for a dried dog turd, sniffed it carefully, and kept it. It was in the park, too, that Stillman rested. In the afternoon, often following his lunch, he would sit on a bench and gaze out across the Hudson. Once, on a particularly warm day, Quinn saw him sprawled out on the grass asleep. When darkness came, Stillman would eat dinner at the Apollo Coffee Shop on 97th Street and Broadway, and then return to his hotel for the night. Not once did he try to contact his son. This was confirmed by Virginia Stillman, whom Quinn called each night after returning home. The essential thing was to stay involved. Little by little, Quinn began to feel cut off from his original intentions, and he wondered now if he had not embarked on a meaningless project. It was possible, of course, that Stillman was merely biding his time, lulling the world into lethargy before striking. But that would assume he was aware of being watched, and Quinn felt that was unlikely. He had done his job well so far, keeping at a discreet distance from the old man, blending into the traffic of the street, neither calling attention to himself nor taking drastic measures to keep himself hidden. On the other hand, it was possible that Stillman had known all along that he would be watched, had even known it in advance, and therefore had not taken the trouble to discover who the particular watcher was. If being followed was a certainty, what did it matter? A watcher, once discovered, could always be replaced by another. This view of the situation comforted Quinn, and he decided to believe in it, even though he had no grounds for belief. Either Stillman knew what he was doing or he didn't, and if he didn't, then Quinn was going nowhere, was wasting his time. How much better it was to believe that all his steps were actually to some purpose. If this interpretation required knowledge on Stillman's part, then Quinn would accept this knowledge as an article of faith, at least for the time being.
This is the end of disc number 2. Please insert disc number 3.